teach that to your kids and to your child, to your children or to your families,
it transcends
them completely. Even if you don't have this concept and you are going through Ramadan is not going to help you out. That Ramadan is basically useless for you, because if you're not following that from your spirit, from your soul.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are following it from your soul, that you know that this Ramadan,
deep down,
it's going to help you out, and you are doing it because God wants you to do it, because you are in love of God. If you are not in love of God, then nothing is going to help you out for every day.
You mean nothing is going to make sense?
Exactly.
Basically,
nothing is going to make
everything
sense.
Everything you do is, as you said,
in greed.
In greed for that kind of eternal paradise.
Yes.
Or it's going to be from the fear of the fire of hell.
But that's a fleeting emotion. It's a fleeting idea in your head that, oh my God, if I don't fast, I'm going to burn in hell.
Yes.
Doing it because I love Allah is just so long lasting, so much more sustainable.
Exactly.
It's something to actually invest in, you know? And
isn't it closer to the idea of ethics?
Exactly. I mean, why else do anything? That the beautiful hadith from Imam al-Baqir, when he was asked, does love have any value in religion? Does it have a place in religion? And Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said, is religion anything but love?
Mm-hmm.
When you look at it that way and you're like, oh my God, God loves me so much that he's personally inviting me to this feast, to this banquet of his own, and I'm his guest, and he's giving me all this opportunity to better myself and to get closer to him. And that just makes you so warm and fuzzy on the inside.
Yes.
You know, you want to do it because he wants you to do it. And there's this love relationship between you is just so much more wholesome than feeling okay, I'm going to do this because I want a mansion in heaven.
Yes.
You know, what has affected this all, great notion of Ramadan with what has destructed is basically the modernism and, Westernism and the consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you take a look at, the history books, 200 years ago,
people
were simple. People didn't have the concept of consumerism. Right now, you are...
Consumerism came with the idea of modernism and technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So now if you go in the Middle East in the month of Ramadan, you would see the guys are playing football all night and sleeping all day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you come to Pakistan, they are probably playing badminton all night. Cricket, yeah. And they are sleeping all day. So there is no sense of Ramadan. What kind of Ramadan is this?
Mm-hmm.
This Ramadan is not helping anyone.
Exactly.
So this consumerism and this modernism, the notion of modernism, had destroyed completely the spirit of Ramadan.
Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said that so many people who fast and they experience nothing but their fast but hunger and thirst.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
That's because that's all they limit it to, To them, it's just
to
refraining the
physical
from
body
refraining
and the senses,
from eating
the five
and drinking.
Senses only.
Exactly. That's it's all about how much you are determined and willing to expand your own capacities, I think. I have actually forgotten what the actual question of the show was. But the thing about the month of Ramadan, change, is if you're willing to expand your capacity for change, not just your diet, not just your eating, not just your drinking, but other aspects of yourself as well.
Right.
And that's the change that the month of Ramadan will bring about for you.
Yes.
But if you want to limit your capacity to just eating and drinking, well, that's all you're going to get from it.
Yes. True.
So,
Brother Ayman, what do you think of the change, positive or negative, going out of Ramadan?
For me or?
Yeah, for you. And the poor Muslim community.
Well, for the Muslim community, as we see right now, as I've given you examples, they're playing badminton, cricket, and football all night. And so it's not helping them at all, right?
You're not against badminton and cricket, of course.
yeah.
Are you
though? Badminton and cricket is getting better. But I think what we need to focus on is basically change the way we teach our kids.
Definitely.
That's the main thing we should focus on right now. We should teach them logically, philosophically, the love of God. That's the main idea.
Say they don't understand, because children understand.
Children understand.
Exactly.
Since I have two kids, and since they have born, I always talk to them in a normal plain language.
Yep, yep, yep.
In Pakistan, if I take my kids over there, they will start talking to them like, oh, gaga googly. And I don't like this way to, you know, talk to kids. I say that just talk like adults.
Mm-hmm.
Treat them as adults,
mm-hmm.
because they are understanding everything.
I see.
My like 2-year-old, he speaks fine now. He's only 2 years old and he's
good.
Speaking perfectly Urdu.
MashaAllah.
Yes.
So, you know, if you need to focus on the main ideas, the main concept, the ideologies that, you know, if we focus on that, you know, we teach our kids philosophically and
mm-hmm.
logically that, you know, we everything is after God.
Mm,
we are just going after the love of God.
I see.
So then everything will start changing.
Sister Zainab, if you were a kid, what would you expect your parents to teach you? For
about the month of Ramadan.
Yes.
What I wish my parents would teach me about the holy month of Ramadan. No, I'm happy with what they taught me, and that it was, they said to me from a young age, I mean, they tried, I was the rebel. My jahiliyyah has nothing to do with my parents, may Allah, shout out to them, I love you, mom and dad. But the fact that they introduced it to me as the month of God,
mm-hmm.
right? It made me feel, and I think that's what I fell back on after I realized that, okay, Zainab, you got to be doing better things with your life, right? You're going to die soon. When they labeled it as the month of God, I felt this sort of significance toward it, you know,
mm-hmm.
in my subconscious, even though I didn't act on it for a really long time. And I felt like it's distinguished from all the other months
mm-hmm.
and all the other occasions.
I see.
And here's the thing, though. Growing up now, I understand so much more about the holy month of Ramadan, not all of it, sadly, but I think I understand more than anything why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put a huge Eid at the
yes.
end of it, because we have gained such an attachment and a love and a bond with the holy month that if it just ends abruptly, we would become depressed. So he puts this big Eid at the end
mm-hmm.
for us to have an excuse, an occasion to celebrate.
Yes.
So that we don't feel so saddened that this great, awesome, bountiful, abundant month is ending.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great sign
mm-hmm.
that you've collected something, you've changed something within yourself
yes.
during the holy month. You
okay.
know?
Yes,
yeah.
True. Thank you very much, Sister Zainab and
Thank
Brother
you.
Ayman.
You're welcome.
May God bless us with this kind of sense and understanding that we make better use of our own time and better prepare ourselves for the life, both in this world and in the other. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
In the limelight.
It's an immutable truth of the climate crisis that the most vulnerable people in the U.S. are hit first and hardest. At a time of rising homelessness in the U.S. and as climate-related disasters become common, wildfires in California, monster hurricanes that thrash the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico, an Arctic blast in Texas, the rule holds, says Andrew McCormick, writer, in an article titled, Homelessness and Extreme Weather are Converging Climate Crises in U.S. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. It's an immutable truth of the climate crisis that most vulnerable people in the United States of America are hit first and hardest. At a time of rising homelessness in the U.S. and as climate-related disasters become common, wildfires in California, monster hurricanes that thrash the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico, and Arctic blasts in Texas, the rule holds. We're definitely seeing more homelessness, more housing disruption as a result of these disasters, said Steve Berg, Programs and Policy Director at the Washington-based National Alliance to End Homelessness. Climate change didn't directly cause the Midwest last year or any of those other disasters. Scientists are clear, however, that a warmer planet makes extreme weather more likely and more ferocious. In both cases, government agencies and nonprofits provide support, but increasingly the needs exceed their capacity. Together, these experiences constitute a grim warning that the climate emergency is here already, draining resources and devastating lives. There are an estimated 580,000 people experiencing homelessness in America, based on a single night count in January 2020, the fourth straight year homelessness had increased, according to a study released last month by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. It was the first year since HUD began collecting data that the number of homeless people with children had gone up. And as usual, people of color remained starkly overrepresented compared to the U.S. population overall. Crucially, that's all pre-pandemic data, and the reality is likely to be worse than we know. Millions lost work because of COVID-19, and even as the economy recovers, there remains 8.4 million fewer jobs than before the pandemic hit. Eviction moratoriums have helped, advocates say, but as some of those expire soon, the situation could grow more dire still. For the homeless, natural disasters prove torturous for more than the obvious fact that it's worse to be outside than inside during the storm. Only one quarter of the homeless population is considered chronically homeless, meaning homeless for more than a year or experiencing repeat bouts of homelessness. At any given time, then, the vast majority of homeless people, including some who are chronically homeless, are scraping their way back toward stability. After disasters, backslide is all but inevitable. Encampments are destroyed. Resources often hard won are lost. If infrastructure is damaged, a job might become more difficult or impossible to get to. Furthermore, many people who are homeless wrestle with untreated medical or mental health conditions that disasters might worsen. In Houston, for example, homeless rates fell year over year starting in 2012. In 2018, the year after Hurricane Harvey, they ticked back up. Last year, 11% of the city's unsheltered homeless population said they had become homeless because of the hurricane or another natural disaster, according to a survey by Houston Coalition for the Homeless. The problem isn't just that homes are destroyed. According to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, America is short nearly 7 million affordable housing units. During an extreme weather event, affordable housing more likely to have been built in disaster-prone areas in the first place is especially vulnerable and often hit the hardest, shrinking the already limited inventory. Pricier homes aren't immune to destruction, of course, so families who are financially better off might also find themselves in need of short-term, lower-cost options. Demand peaks at the same time that options are depleted the most. Disasters of this magnitude really trickle out, said Anna Roach, Program Operations Director at the Coalition for the Homeless. After Harvey, she said, our regular housing of the homeless pretty much came to a halt because we were trying to house people in the disaster shelters and not all those individuals were homeless. Pattern goes like this. Disasters push people who had been housing secure toward insecurity. People who were already insecure to severely burdened by housing costs are pushed to the edge of homelessness. And finally, people who were already homeless are pushed further back in the long wait for limited resources. The web of government agencies and nonprofits designed to help, meanwhile, is stretched to the max. Between coronavirus relief measures passed during the Trump administration and the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan that the current administration signed last month, nearly $80 billion was allocated to HUD, the Treasury Department, and various federal grant recipients to fight homelessness and housing instability, a HUD spokesperson said in an email.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
We get people.
U.S. Police Lethal Force.
Guilty, guilty, guilty. Former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin was finally found guilty of all of the charges against him, including third-degree murder. And that happened nearly a year after the footage of him kneeling on George Floyd's neck shocked everyone in the world.
Today, you have the cameras all around the world to see and show what happened to my brother. It was a motion picture, the world seeing his life being extinguished. And I could do nothing but watch, especially in that courtroom, over and over and over again as my brother was murdered. Times, they're getting harder every day.
Hello and welcome to We the People. We've dedicated this episode of the show to George Floyd. We will ask, was justice served? Is systematic racism over or being swept under the table? I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. From police brutality to gun policy in this episode, thank you for staying with us.
When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad, I look at my brothers, I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. I have a black father, I have a black brother, I have black friends. And I look at that and I look at how that could have been one of them. It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
The rare moment of accountability gave the nation a small opportunity to exhale, with injustice raging on. The death of George Floyd triggered protests across the United States and the world in solidarity with his family, along with calls to end police brutality and systematic racism running rampant within the U.S. law enforcement and justice system.
And I'm so happy. I'm so, so happy right now. God, if you can just feel every beat of my heart, you know. Yet, it's crucial not to represent the latest verdict as a panacea for structured racism. In other words, the system may want to portray Chauvin as an isolated racist in the police department, while in reality, white police officers targeting African Americans on racial grounds abound. We have Dr. Jared Ball with us to delve deeper into the case. He's a professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Morgan State University, also an author and radio host. Dr. Ball, welcome to our program.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Ball, what does the outcome of the George Floyd case mean for the nation's struggle to tackle racial injustice in America?
Well, in reality, it means very, very little. And we've already seen just shortly before the verdict came down on Derek Chauvin, Makia Bryant was killed. We saw just the other day Andrew Brown killed in North Carolina. Right around the corner, we saw Dante Wright killed. And of course, in Chicago, we saw 13-year-old Adam Toledo killed. So in terms of real-time, practical, lived experience, reality, the trial means very little.
May 25th, 2020, Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Floyd is arrested after allegedly passing a counterfeit $20 bill at a Cub Foods grocery store. 17 minutes into the arrest, and Floyd is now unconscious. He is handcuffed face down in the street with Chauvin kneeling on his neck.
You're a tough guy. You're a tough guy, huh?
I love y'all ass.
You're a tough guy. You're not even resisting arrest, bro. Bro, but why you just sitting there? He ain't doing nothing now. Put him in the car. It ain't about drugs, bro. Y'all understand that, but you don't got to have his hand in his neck, bro. He is human, bro. But I'm saying, you can put him in the car.
Onlookers fail to call for help or convince the aggressive cop to let him breathe. Officers take no action to treat him. But the footage capturing his demise is about to cause international outcry.
In the upcoming days, Chauvin would first be fired by the Minneapolis Police Department, arrested and charged with murder. Our next guest is Garland Nixon, a radio talk show host and political analyst with over 20 years of experience in law enforcement and currently serving on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Nixon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be on.
Thank you. So what does Chauvin's conviction mean?
In my opinion, it doesn't mean anything. And, you know, certainly there is the natural euphoria whenever something like this happens that seems, you know, positive. And, of course, it is positive. But in my opinion, in a case where it's so blatantly obvious that this was a murder, that this was it for all of the world to see, I don't feel good about the outcome. I just feel that the outcome is exactly what it should have been. And the fact that we're discussing this outcome, the fact that people were concerned as to whether Derek Chauvin would be found guilty, in my opinion, demonstrates that we have a long way to go. So I don't see this as a, you know, the end of the struggle. I see it as representative of how bad things are in America for people of color, for, as Malcolm X referred to us, for our internal people who are, you know, trapped in our internal colonies.
It takes some 10 months for a trial to begin, with Minneapolis and the rest of the nation on edge while Black Lives Matter protests continue. After a 3-week trial, Chauvin is ultimately convicted of all the 3 criminal counts he was facing. up to 40 years in prison for second-degree murder, up to 25 years for third-degree murder, and up to 10 years for second-degree manslaughter.
Is there a motion on behalf of the state?
They would move to have the court revoke the defendant's bail and remand him into custody, pending sentencing.
Bail is revoked, bond is discharged, and the defendant is remanded to the custody of the Hennepin County Sheriff. Anything further?
All right.
Thank you.
Derek Chauvin rises. His eyes had been flicking. He watched intently. He is now handcuffed and led away, remanded into custody, having been found guilty of 3 charges.
In reality, the sentence could be reduced to as short as 15 years. The police department Chauvin used to work for abandoned him. Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo even testified in the trial that the former officer's use of force against Floyd had exceeded the guidelines of police training.
I don't think anybody who's looking at this situation here seriously could suggest that this is a victory or a proof or a sign of even advance. Again, those who paid any attention to the trial or the reporting of the trial saw a situation where Chauvin, who had overwhelming evidence against him, was thrown under the bus, so to speak, even by his own leadership, where his own police chief went out of his way in the mind of at least some of us to make it clear that Chauvin is to be seen as the exception to the rule, as anomalous, or as, again, something that could be corrected, as the often used phrase here, the one bad apple. But in reality, Chauvin, as it was also made clear through his situation or positioning as a trainer of other police, was anything but anomalous, but was in fact the rule, or as others have put it, he was the feature and not the bug.
Cases of police brutality against people of color did not often end like this. Between the Chauvin trial on March 29, 2020 and now, tens of people have been killed by law enforcement officers nationwide. Yet Chauvin's case got so much attention because the world could see for itself what actually happened on that day.
Historical protest. I'm sure this is one of the biggest protests in history. It's for sure the biggest protest against racism, against police violence.
What is your purpose for being here? If you want to believe that we in the Netherlands do not have a problem with race, you should go ahead and go home.
I really believe that the problems that they have is nothing to do with a few bad apples. It's an institutional problem, and it has to be addressed.
Some African Americans behind the prosecution of Chauvin were in a celebratory mood after the trial, although many reminded the nation that justice is yet to materialize for the people of color. It is not common in the United States to see guilty verdicts against police officers killing black people. Yet, if he had somehow escaped justice, a serious unrest could have unraveled.
I do not believe that you can get justice in America from the American government unless you can get justice everywhere. Here's the example, the analogy that I use. You know, if a man goes to the bar and he gets drunk and he gets in a fight, and then on the way home, he gets in an argument with another driver and he gets in a fight. And then he gets out of his car at his home and he gets in an argument and he gets in a fight with his next door neighbor. When he comes home, he's going to be violent and abusive to his family because he has a violent and abusive nature.
Chauvin's conviction is highly unlikely to represent a turning point in the African Americans' struggle to attenuate racial profiling, police brutality, and anti-black hate. It rather represents a random and single case in which justice has been served. It also raises questions about the functionality of the U.S. justice system, particularly when it comes to the cases where it has to hold a white cop accountable for killing an innocent black man. It It was immediately clear to any fair-minded person that Chauvin murdered Floyd, but it took nearly a year for the US justice system to come to that conclusion. Therefore, the Floyd story, one of police brutality, injustice, and of course corruption, is bound to continue.
What is called the American justice system moves slowly, in most cases, just as a practical matter. But in reality, as often is the case, attempts are made to delay the presentation of facts and trials so as to allow public sentiment to change or at least calm down in the hopes that the results either will go better for the defendant or subsequent to their conviction that at least or potential acquittal, probably even more so, that the uproarious response would be limited or somehow suppressed or reduced.
Gun violence and police brutality are commonly reported in the United States, and recently it has claimed yet another life, this time a 13-year-old Hispanic boy shot dead in Chicago. Adam Toledo was downed by the bullet fired by Officer Eric Stillman, who chased him down an alley after Toledo and his friend started shooting at a car.
Officer Stillman yelled at Adam to show if he is unarmed.
Show me your head!
A second later, Adam's right arm moves. Something appears to be in his hand. Another second later, at 2:38 and 40 seconds, Adam raises both his hands, empty, into the air. Then, he is shot. By 2:38:41, the 13-year-old is on the floor dying.
Decree after a Department of Justice investigation obliged Chicago to make hundreds of changes in policing as it found a decades-long record of racism and abuse by Chicago police. So how could the U.S. police be held accountable?
I've argued to the people who are marching, whether it's Black Lives Matter or various other groups that are fighting for equality in America, that the difference between our foreign policy and our domestic policy is grammatical and nothing else. The United States has fought around the world to stop the International Criminal Court from holding our troops responsible for war crimes in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries. So if they will not hold, if our government will not hold our military personnel responsible for violence against people in other countries, they certainly will not do it here. What we're seeing is a reflection of how our empire works.
Trust in police departments is in short supply among the people of color, including the Latin community in the U.S., and that appears unlikely to change. The Biden-Harris administration has been perforated on issues of crime and lawlessness in the streets. Their record on gun control and gun confiscation is not shining, according to most Americans.
I've seen with my own two eyes what a bullet can do to the human body. I've held hands with the hands of parents who have lost a child. I have seen children who were traumatized by the loss of a parent or sibling. And I have fought my entire career to end this violence and to pass reasonable gun safety laws. Time and again, as progress has stalled, we've all asked, what are we waiting for?
There's reportedly widespread public support for tougher gun laws. However, ambitious measures on that path are suppressed in the US political system. Biden has a limited plan for guns, but of course, he will have to encounter some of the most powerful organizations in America. Whether the U.S. gun policy is set to change is yet to be seen. But what could the black people do? Mr. Bull.
There is no other solution other than black communities, brown communities, so-called communities of color in this country have to organize politically, have to organize with a certain level of radicalism and militancy to, again, start with self-protection units in their own communities, self-defensive units, and then the development of platforms, politicians, and political campaigns to assume political power that will give community control over policing and redirect resources differently so that those communities can be sustained and develop in a more healthy and holistic, humane way.
Gun violence and police brutality will unfortunately continue in the country.
Their deep-rooted issues mingled with racism, existing not just in the police force, but among some of the people. Let's hear from the man himself.
Our young generation is clearly lost, man. Clearly lost, man. Like, I don't even know what to say no more, man. Like, you youngsters just going around, just busting guns in crowds, kids getting killed, you know, and it's clearly the generation after us, man, that's so lost, man.
On this episode of We the People, I'm joined by justice journalist Chuck Modi. He's a sports writer and a columnist for Deadspin. Chuck, thanks for being with us. Now, racism in U.S. policing is certainly nothing new. In fact, it's been a defining characteristic since inception, when so-called slave patrols were among the earliest iterations of American cops. Over the past several decades, there have been many high-profile cases of racist police terror, with the infamous beating of Rodney King by the LAPD being among the most notorious, but almost none of them has resulted in a conviction of a police officer, until now. So Chuck, what was it about this recent case that allowed for a cop, Derek Chauvin, to finally face consequences for the murder of George Floyd?
Well, the circumstances are definitely unique, Wyatt. First of all, most of these other cases, you don't have a 9.5 minute video, and we won't have a 9.5 minute video for the next killing. They're usually more bang bang. So that is unique in and of itself. The jurors saw the torture that was happening. Another unique aspect is that this murder was so ugly, was so devastating, that actual police officers testified against Chauvin. And that is so incredibly rare. So even in reaching the verdict, you needed the validation from other police officers, including the police chief, including the head of training, including officers, to validate what our eyes could tell us very easily in those 9 minutes, if you could make it through. So this was unique, and I don't believe you can take anything away as far as, is this some new day in accountability? Because you're not going to have another case quite like this. The very few times the officer has come back, like the Danziger Bridge shootings in 2005 post-Katrina, another officer will turn someone in, you may get something, but you can't take anything away.
So if, as you say, this doesn't necessarily mean that there's a new day in police accountability, what does it mean exactly? And what do you make of the idea that I've heard from some organizers that this conviction really boils down to the unprecedented wave of public pressure that we saw with last summer's historic Black Lives Matter protests?
That idea is absolutely true. If we go back to the beginning of the video, the DA, Mike Freeman, wasn't arresting Derek Chauvin. It took an uprising. People all across the country uprising, including in Minneapolis, to really get the message across to force the arrest of Derek Chauvin. The people did that. Without that uprising, Derek Chauvin is probably walking like so many other people, Malton Sterling in Louisiana, despite incredible video. But those were sustained protests, and we hadn't seen protests so sustained for so long. And then a lot of white people came out of these protests too. I don't want to underestimate that as well. So you had a new crowd, you had new pressure that was going on, and that certainly made a difference. While it made a difference in that case, we also know during the Derek Chauvin trial, a whole myriad of other individuals were killed or brutalized by police.
Right. It feels like not a day goes by that there's not another police killing where race seems to play a key role. In the past week, we've seen the police gun down people like 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant in Columbus, Ohio, Andrew Brown in North Carolina. I think the big question here is, when does it end? If not now, if this isn't a turning point, is there any light at the end of the tunnel here?
Well, it seemed like it increased. You just mentioned Andrew Brown, and there was protest for him in North Carolina today. We know about Dante Wright a couple of weeks ago in the Minneapolis Brooklyn Center. There were protests. We know Adam Toledo in Chicago, who, as he's putting his hands up, was shot. And this doesn't even the fact that the officer who shot Jacob Blake went back on duty last week barely made the news. It was a blip. And I could go on and on. There was a black lieutenant who was pepper sprayed by cops. We've seen these videos every single day. So whatever the verdict did in any or didn't do, it did not stop police killing. It did not stop police brutality. So I think what you're seeing is you're seeing continued protests. You're seeing a protest in North Carolina, as I just mentioned. In D.C., there have been protests all week. I've covered three protests. And there was one in regards to Micaiah Bryant. There was one in regards to police terror in general. And then on Saturday, there was one again. But it was specifically not just police accountability, but it showed a distinction that the protesters want to defund police. That's the language we're hearing, or abolish the police. And they're going far beyond the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that we're hearing on TV. So one protester had said on Saturday that the D.C. police has a $543 million budget. We need to cut that budget. And also made the remark that $43 million was moved this year from Department of Health in D.C. so that there was no problem defunding health services. There's no problem defunding schools. There's no problem defunding Social Security. But when that same conversation goes on to people getting away with murder, literally, then it becomes a problem. And this is the disconnect between the protester in the street and what we're hearing at the administrative and presidential level.
Yeah, I think it's no surprise that we are seeing that disconnect between progressive activists and the Biden administration continue to grow. Well, we want to thank Chuck Modiano so much for joining us tonight. We want to thank viewers at home for tuning in for Press TV's We the People. In Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed.
It's no surprise that violence in the streets could cause even more police brutality, while racism and xenophobia against minorities such as Africans and Asians could play a big part in both. Chauvin will be sentenced on June 16, but the plight of minorities are not to lessen. It remains to be seen whether efforts for a fair society would start to pay off. I'm your host, Mila Java Magi. Please join us again next week on We the People.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, and this is Sayyid Vahid. Welcome to the Month of Allah. I hope that you enjoy our programs. And I will continue talking about the food nutritions, and especially during the holy month of Ramadan. We reach to this part that you should not use solid vegetable oils. And the reason is that these oils, especially in cooking, as they become trans fatty acids, all right? They are saturated fats. And these types of fats are also found in ready-made foods. And this is harmful, especially when you are fasting. Use a lot of nuts and large fish because they have unsaturated fat, which is good fat. Do not fill your plate. Do not eat so much food that you cannot eat. So stay hungry, have a small appetite left, and this applies especially to high-calorie foods. Keep your intake of cholesterol below 300 milligrams a day. Cholesterol is found in animal foods such as red meat, chicken, dairy, and egg yolks. Take enough calcium. Calcium is very important for strengthening the bones and strengthening teeth. And you may find this in drugstores and pharmacies if you have problems with your calcium, you can buy it as a tablet and eat it besides your food. Do not use solid vegetable oils in cooking, as they become trans fatty acids, saturated fats, all right? These types of fats are also found in ready-made foods. Use a lot of nuts and large fish because they have unsaturated fat, and that's good fat. Take enough calcium. Calcium is very important for the strengthening of your bones and strengthening your teeth. Provide calcium from low-fat foods such as low-fat milk or low-fat yogurt. And if you have problems with your calcium, you can buy tablets for it in a drugstore or in a pharmacy, and which you can consume besides your food. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem. وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن
The Light.
Lebanon has unveiled its first indigenously produced electric car, which is also the first ever car manufactured in the country. The red sports car Quds Rise is named after the Palestinian holy city of Jerusalem Al-Quds, which remains under Israel's occupation. The car is adorned at the front with a golden logo of the Dome of the Rock, signifying the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. It's the project of Lebanese-born Palestinian businessman Jihad Mohammed.
We have two sources of electricity. There is the state's electricity that are the generators, so we pay to 10 recharging stations, and we are looking for secure places to install them.
The company hopes to start the production of up to 10,000 units of his electric sports car in Lebanon later this year. Jihad Mohammed says his long-term goal is to compete on international markets for hybrid and electric cars, as well as to make sales in Lebanon. People around the world have been grounded by the coronavirus, with many being forced to work from home. But the Scottishman has made a secluded cliffside a perfect spot against a pandemic-induced change to working habits. Jason Griffin's 34-year-old call center consultant from Glasgow has put remote working technology to the test by moving his office to a dangling shelf off the Irish Sea. His move is seen as an attempt to give rise to the digital nomad, meaning people can use technology to work from wherever connectivity is possible. Griffin says as long as there is a mobile connection and his laptop, he has everything he needs to do his job.
Today we are pushing the technology to its limits because we're going over cliff face and we're abseiling down to a ledge, and I will be working all day from that ledge and taking and making calls, interacting with internal staff, just showing that remote literally means remote.
Griffins has set up a temporary office on a cliff face to prove that its performance is as good as a busy office. Call centres are one sector where remote working and technology has kept companies connected to customers. But the digital revolution has seen an inclination towards working remotely. Large chocolate reproduction of Picasso's iconic painting of Guernica has gone on display in the Basque country town, A steady stream of residents has visited the artistic work created by 40 Basque chocolatiers. The work of art is expected to stay in Guernica until it tours different Spanish and European cities. The move marks the 84th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica in northern Spain by Nazi Germany. Picasso painted Guernica to portray the suffering of people and animals wrought by violence and chaos. Upon completion, Guernica was put on display at a Paris exposition in 1937. In a remote part of Pakistan, two sisters have come up with a unique idea to help children continue their education during pandemic-related school closures, a camel library. The mobile library visits four villages in Pakistan's largest province of Balochistan. Children borrow books and return them the next time the camel visits. The project was founded by a local high school principal and her sister. Rahima Jalal says she started the project because she wanted children around her remote hometown to continue learning despite schools being closed.
When the coronavirus spread, the entire region and all the schools were closed. There was an atmosphere of depression for old and young alike. The region where I live, there is no entertainment for children at all, no place for outings. The only activity is the children going to school and coming back home. After the schools had remained closed for 8 or 9 months due to COVID, we started wondering what we could do for the children. How could we start some sort of activity which would keep children busy and also be of some benefit to them?
Pakistan closed the schools early in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic and sent some 50 million school and university students home. The closures put children in Balochistan at particular risk of falling behind, as the province is Pakistan's most impoverished. Even though some schools have reopened, children in this region still have trouble accessing educational resources.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter has successfully completed its third flight on the red planet while moving farther and faster than ever before. It was nothing short of amazing, says the Ingenuity Project's program executive. The drone covered 50 meters of distance, reaching the speed of nearly 2 meters per second. In its latest flight, the helicopter filmed 80 seconds of video, which are to be sent to Earth in the coming days. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration says similar flights are yet to come, with each planned to be of increasing difficulty in order to push Ingenuity to its limits. The experiment will end in 1 month in order to let Perseverance return to its main task, searching for signs of past microbial life on Mars.
When spring arrives, nature is lively and in bloom. This generous season brings with it merriment for humans and animals alike, as they can freely enjoy the greenery. A herd of cows in Sweden have gotten their first chance to graze in green open fields after being cooped up in their farms for the whole winter due to the harsh cold. The event was broadcast live so people could enjoy watching these happy animals springing around. Sweden's traditional cow release ceremony attracts thousands of visitors every year.
Barcelona's famous Casa Batlló has been decorated with hundreds of artificial red roses on the occasion of St. George's Day, a Christian celebration also known as the Feast of St. George. For those in Catalonia, the floral decoration of Antoni Gaudí's architectural masterpiece means the arrival of spring. Many locals say that after a year of lockdown amid pandemic, the decoration seems like a recovery for them. Catalans normally celebrate the occasion in large groups outdoors, But this year, COVID-19 has prevented their traditional way of celebrations. However, they say Casa Batel's roses have sparked a sense of enthusiasm that life is eventually going back to normal in some way. A Dutch photographer has captured stunning footage of a super yacht passing through narrow canals of the Netherlands. Tom van Usanen used a drone to record the transportation of the gigantic vessel from its initial facility to the North Sea. The 94 meters long yacht, known as Project 817, is one of the largest vessels to be launched this year. It has been designed to precisely fit the waterways, and even a few centimeters cannot be added to its length or width. The duration of the yacht's transportation also depends on a variety of factors, including winds and the schedule of the bridges. For this super yacht, the mission took 4 days to be completed. Space radar capable of capturing small objects that threaten the safety of astronauts and satellites has been inaugurated at a farm in northwestern Costa Rica. The four large panels that make up the radar are connected to the servers of an aerospace company in San Francisco in the U.S. state of California. The system uses a continuous series of radio frequencies that bounce off materials in orbit and send information back to the servers. An American astronaut present at the ceremony says the radar is most advanced of its kind in the world.
Now this radar, which is the most advanced commercial radar for space tracking in the world, what it does is it sends radio signals into space. As Franklin said, even an object the size of a golf ball traveling at 30,000 kilometers per hour overhead, a tiny amount of those radio waves will bounce off it and can be picked up by these giant reflector dishes behind us.
Costa Rican President Carlos Alvarado also joined by American and domestic astronauts during the event. The radar can monitor objects that transit in low Earth orbit near the equator, an average or an advantage offered by Costa Rica's geographical location.
A museum in London has transformed its gift shop into a mini supermarket selling artist-designed food to help an industry largely affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The Design Museum has reopened its shop with the help of 10 artists. It sells essential products with packaging designed by emerging artists. The market offers goods at the same price of normal markets, both online and at a marketplace. The initiative is led by Camille Walala, who says her project is aimed at supporting the artist reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the project is to support artists, and I think because obviously at the moment there's no exhibition, people can't really show any of their creative work, and it's nice to have like a feedback when you're creative. It's nice to know, you know, if people like your work. I think this is a really nice platform to just bring artwork on like everyday product, and actually people are going to probably come and just buy them and probably keep them as a piece of art, like, you know, an affordable piece of art from some artist that you like. I think it's a really nice way to display art, so yeah, I think.
Walala says the project also conveys the message that creativity is as important for a living as the other essentials. She says the creative supermarket will also help the museum, which has seen a drop of more than 90% in income because of the pandemic. The shop is open for just 5 days, but artists expect heavy demand.
IRIB English Radio.